Are you searching for an education that forms not just the mind, but the soul? At Thomas More College of Liberal Arts, we believe learning should be more than just getting a degree. It should be about discovering truth, beauty, and virtue. Located in the beautiful and historic Merrimack Valley, Thomas More College is a Catholic liberal arts college dedicated to the great books and the pursuit of wisdom. But here students don't just study philosophy, theology, literature, history and classical languages. They engage in lively discussions in small, close-knit classes, guided by devoted professors. And they don't just learn about faith, they live it. Through a vibrant Catholic community, daily mass, and a curriculum rooted in the teachings of the Church. Every student at Thomas More College also spends a full semester in Rome, at no extra cost beyond tuition. In the heart of Christendom, they walk the same streets as saints and scholars, study in the shadow of St. Peter's Basilica, and experience Catholic culture in a way that no textbook ever could. If you, or someone you know, is looking for an education that challenges the intellect and nourishes the soul, visit thomasmorecollege.edu to learn more. Thomas More College. Experience more. Welcome to Merely Catholic with me, Gavin Ashenden. Lord David Alton is one of our best-known politicians. He's also one of the longest-serving. He was elected to the House of Commons in 1979 and in 1997 became a member of the House of Lords. He's particularly well known for his work on human rights. He co-founded Jubilee Action, the children's charity, which became Chance for Childhood in 2014. And recently in 2024, he was elected chair of the UK Parliament Joint Committee on Human Rights. He's always been at the forefront of the attempt to protect the unborn in the face of increasingly draconian legislation and, at the same time, to defend the elderly in the face of the progressive agenda on euthanasia. He's particularly well known for having forged a very effective alliance of like-minded politicians and drawing them around him in order to resist some of the worst progressive prospects in the legislation that we're being faced. In a week in British politics where both the unborn and the elderly are severely threatened by new legislation, he's taken a leading role as an outspoken critic, and he joins me today on Merely Catholic. Lord David Alton, thank you very much for joining us today. It's a terrible occasion, but we're very grateful to have your commentary because we find ourselves in uncharted waters, theologically, politically, socially, and in terms of the criminal law. Can I begin by asking you whether you thought the legislation was actually going to go through because it's draconian and unprecedented?
There were several amendments which were laid before the House of Commons around the issue of abortion. And it was clear to me that the sympathies of the majority of new members of the House of Commons were going to be in a pro-abortion direction. So I did fear that one of the amendments would go through. There was one, which was hard to believe, would have been even more draconian, even harsher than the one which was passed. But what shocked me, and I was a member of the House of Commons for nearly 20 years, I cannot recall ever where such a major ethical, moral question was considered and rushed through at such a pell-mell pace, all done in a couple of hours, with only a handful of speeches being made on the floor of the House, and even they were truncated, and a vote taken at the end of it. So there was a predisposition amongst a lot of people who are very ideologically committed to the idea of the total deregulation of laws around the protection of human life. The only encouraging thing I can say is that as a boy at school back in 1967, I collected a petition against the legalization of abortion and sent it to the Member of Parliament who was promoting that legislation at the time. Only 29 members of the House of Commons voted against the original legislation. Today, there are very many more, hundreds of people either in the House now or who were previously in the House or people trying to get elected to the House who share a pro-life position. So in some ways, the shocking nature of this amendment, which has been passed, which we should talk about perhaps in a moment, that I hope will just shake people out of their lethargy, attract even more people to the cause of the unborn child and the right to life, and maybe demonstrate to people that this isn't just a personal matter of choice. This is something that's determined by law, by Parliament. And Parliament ultimately is only as good as the people who put the parliamentarians there, or for that matter, remove them. So people must make this the defining issue of how they exercise their right to vote.
There are so many questions I want to ask you, and getting them in the right order isn't always straightforward. I want to ask you, is there therefore a parliamentary route to going back to the status quo that's accessible? I want to ask you, if I was a kind of political psychotherapist, I would want to ask questions about the drama, the speed, and the intensity of a process that was wholly inappropriate to the matter under discussion. I'd also like to ask you about the ideological background. So let's what order to do things in. So the political one first of all, is there a way back?
Well, there's always a way back. And indeed, this legislation will have to come to the House of Lords. And I can assure you that there are members of the Lords, such as myself, who will seek to change the decision of the House of Commons. But in the end, they are the elected House. And if in the end they insist, under our constitution, and rightly so, the elected House will always get its way. But we do have the right in the Lords to challenge, to scrutinise, and to send things back to the Commons. Quite recently, I promoted an amendment about Uyghur slave labour in Xinjiang in China, and the purchase of things like solar panels. Well, it became quite controversial, and it ping-ponged, as we put it in Parliament, between both houses. And ultimately, I persuaded the government and the House of Commons to accept the amendment that we moved in the Lords. So it's not impossible to change things. But on an issue of this kind, which is so emotive and highly charged and has become so ideological, I think it will be very difficult. Nevertheless, I mean, I would be in favour. I've already said this to a number of colleagues here. I'm an independent member of the House of Lords, and I have colleagues and friends on all sides of the House. I've already said to them that we must move an amendment which at least says that nothing may be done using this new legislation that takes the life of a viable unborn child. So I think we must make that the straightforward issue. Are you in favour or are you against the principle of taking the life of an unborn child right up to and even during the course of their birth? Because that's what the new legislation allows. But it did allow precisely that before in one set of cases. The case of people with disabilities. Since 1990, I challenged it then when I was in the House of Commons, we have permitted abortion up to and even during birth on a child because of a disability. Now, very few of the abortions that take place, there have been 10 million of them since 1967, were on the grounds of disability. But if you take Down syndrome as one example, since that law was changed, 90% of all babies who have Down syndrome are routinely aborted. That isn't just abortion, it's also eugenics. It's taking the life because somebody isn't regarded as being a fit and proper person to even have the right to be born. So we should be clear about this. This is an extension of an existing principle. This means that in any case, right up to the moment of birth, so 1 minute before birth, 1 minute before birth, you can be legally aborted with no consequences for the person who carries out the abortion, if it is the mother herself, although if a doctor were involved, for instance, he would be criminally responsible. How can you be a criminal in one set of circumstances but not in another? 1 minute after birth, on the other hand, the person, anybody taking the life of that child, it would be called infanticide, could be arrested and charged with murder. This is a ludicrous situation to have got ourselves into, but it is ideologically driven, and it's because we have lost a complete belief in the sanctity, the uniqueness, the preciousness of every human life.
I'd like to ask you more about the ideology in a minute, but first of all, continue the question about can it be changed. I've always thought politically that the way in which our two houses works is that the teenagers are in the House of Commons and the grown-ups in the House of Lords, partly because you get into the House of Lords notionally on competence and expertise. Anyone can be elected into the House of Commons if they can persuade people to vote for them. And so the role of the Lords is enormously important. And you can whilst you can't, whilst the will of the Commons obviously prevails, there are all kinds of things the Lords can do, including drawing attention to the public to ideological difficulties that the House of Commons has presented for itself. So it's very good, encouraging to hear that that's going to take place. Do you think that, and this will bring us on to the ideology question in a moment, do you think that by continuing to present the arguments as you've just done now in public, there is any sense that the media at any rate will want to challenge the driven ideology of the Commons? People have been talking about the left as being the party of death, a death to the unborn children, death to the elderly. It's almost as if the utopian left have got a preoccupation with killing the wrong kind of people. To what extent is there any appetite for the media hearing what the grown-ups have to say as they expose the pitfalls of the ideology for the House of Commons?
Well, let's be careful about this. It would be easy to say it's just a left-right issue. I mean, I prefer to say it's a right or wrong issue. There were Labour members of Parliament who voted against this provision. Virtually every Liberal Democrat, on the other hand, just two of them, voted against it, the change. They wouldn't regard themselves as leftist ideologues. But the ideology around this is not about left or right. It's about the uniqueness of life itself and where you stand on that issue. And of course, this week, we're not merely deciding on the right to life of an unborn child. We're also considering euthanasia legislation in the guise of so-called assisted dying. And the House of Commons will be voting on that tomorrow again. But opening these debates sometimes, you move from the point where people are either sitting on the fence, have taken Trappist vows of silence, and suddenly they become radicalized and feel that they've got to start speaking out. And it may be, I think, indeed, it will be the case that regardless of what the House of Lords is able to do, and it's nice of you to say we're regarded as the grown-ups, but the same ideology affects quite a lot of the membership of the House of Lords, people who have been appointed here in recent times particularly. I've seen a significant change in the couple of decades that I've been a member. But there are people of hugely important experience and who have a view of life, which I hope is a more rounded one. But in the end, it will be the public who will determine these events. And we've seen the public giving the elites and people who come from a small L liberal disposition. Tim Farron made the point last week on the issue of assisted dying, where he said, this is about libertarianism versus liberalism. True liberalism, he said, is about people standing up for the vulnerable, speaking up for the voiceless, speaking up for powerless people. So that, for me, is where the dividing line stands. And where is the public on this? One poll I've seen shows that only 1% of people polled actually think this move to allow abortion up to and even during birth is something that they support. So I think overwhelmingly public opinion will be opposed to what the House of Commons has decided, and that is what we have to draw out. I mean, in my day when I promoted bills to challenge the abortion laws, on one occasion, over 1 million cards and letters arrived at the House of Commons post office. It was unprecedented, from people who wanted a change in the law to protect the unborn child. And it woke people up. People had tried to say, oh, it's all over. We've changed the law. We now have legal abortion. You should just go away. No one cares about it anymore. Well, we demonstrated then that people did care about it. And the same thing has got to happen now. We're very fortunate that there are charities and groups like Right to Life who do a brilliant job in mobilizing opinion, not least, of course, on things like social media. I put up a post on Twitter about this decision in the House of Commons. Thousands of people have already looked at that, and I've affirmed it or disagreed with it. But the debate is going on there, and we've got to do more of that. You know, even my generation has got to recognize that you can make your speech in the House of Lords, but you've got to reach ordinary people and mobilize them and get them right into the representatives in the House of Commons. And when people in the House of Commons see that their constituents may sit up and bite them, as they did on issues like Brexit, as they did in voting for the Reform Party and things like that, when they see that people take this seriously enough to say that my vote is conditional on what you're going to do about the aborting of a baby right up to and even during birth, and even on grounds such as sex selection. I mean, how you repackage the arguments, I think, is important here. And I, you know, for my sins, one of the things I was elected to do in the House here is to chair the Joint Committee on Human Rights between the House of Lords and the House of Commons. There are 12 of us who are members of that. We spend a lot of time talking about human rights. Well, the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, which was fashioned in 1948 after the Holocaust, has 30 articles in it. I would encourage people to read Article 3, which says that no one shall be deprived of their life intentionally. We hear a lot of argument about the European Convention on Human Rights, which we are a signatory to. Article 2 says that no one shall be deprived of their life and arbitrarily deprived of their life. Well, this decision is purely arbitrary, but as a matter of choice, you can eliminate a human life. And our opponents have got to say, when do they believe that life begins? Then, in that case, science teaches us that it's from the moment of conception. But even if you don't accept that, what about viability? And that's the issue I think the House of Lords should try to unite people around. But at least let's accept that a viable child, and we've had babies born from around 22, 23 weeks gestation, that you cannot, after that, eliminate someone purely on the basis of things like human rights laws and legislation. So even if you don't subscribe to encyclicals or to Catholic teaching or to the position of the late Chief Rabbi Jonathan Sacks, you know, wonderful people who can give you all the theological and the ethical arguments for opposing this, there are other grounds which people themselves should at least feel uneasy about.
Well, thank you very much for refining my broad brush political view by saying there are people on the left who are concerned about voting right rather than wrong, and that needs to be heard. And so I'm thank you for modifying my generality. What you're talking about is energizing and informing people in the population about the morality. And I want to thank you for everything you've done, because I remember, not being a Catholic, being very impressed at the way in which you had led the campaign to save human life. I didn't change my views until I was actually in the middle of I had a BBC Faith and Ethics program I was presenter of, and I was one of the, as so many people, agnostic about the issue of abortion. And a lady phoned in, probably a Catholic, saying she was upset about it. And I let her talk. Why she did, I Googled. I thought I'd better inform myself about the exact state of the law and the numbers. You say there have been 10 million. At this stage, there have been 6 million abortions. Yeah. And I said on air, 6 million, that's a resonant number in European history for all of us. I said that ought to cause us all to think, because if these are viable human beings, and we have disposed of 6 million of them, then that you know, there are dots to be joined. I was on the carpet of the editor the next morning, who said, "If ever you say something like that on the BBC Live again, we'll pull the plug on you." That in itself,
yeah,
caused me to think, and was part of my own journey towards becoming a Catholic, because really, although there are some wonderful fellow travellers with us who can tell the difference between right and wrong, it is the Catholic Church that has energised the debate with an unparalleled commitment. To what extent do you see this as a Christian secular, Christian pagan watershed? Because it is not a Christian. The Christians defined themselves from the earliest years by refusing pagan infanticide of the societies they lived in. Is one of the marks of being a Christian society, because we believe in the sanctity of life, because everyone is made in God's image. But we're increasingly a post-Christian, some would say an anti-Christian country. What is your view on the temperature, if you like, since you have talked about the absolutes of right and wrong that to transcend political allegiance? Can we pounce on people being Christian enough in our society to maintain the insight that Christians and particularly Catholics bring to this ethical issue?
Well, it's a good question, Gavin, but if you go to look at the debate, this week's debate, the member of the House of Commons, the woman who was moving the motion to allow abortion up to birth, she said, it seemed boastfully in the course of her speech, that she'd been raised Catholic. And the sadness for me is, whether we're Catholic or not, Christian or not, this is a human rights question. And although the Catholic Church's teaching has been clear, there are plenty of people who take it with a pinch of salt or have cafeteria Christianity, choose the bits that they want, but not the bits they don't want. And I think that we can, therefore, we do have to, therefore, ask ourselves some questions about whether we have been clear enough about this. Certainly, recent popes have been absolutely clear about the taking of human life. But I'm married to an Anglican. We met through pro-life work, deeply committed to the unborn child throughout her whole life. I note that in the debate on this week in the Commons, that looking at the division list, that many Muslim members of the House of Commons voted to protect the life of the unborn child. And I have atheist friends who are on our side of the argument too. So it's not quite as clear again as to say, well, it's our little group here and against all the others. I think we all have to search ourselves and our hearts and minds about this. And have we done enough? And you're quite right when you talk about the way that you can be airbrushed out. I used to do a lot of political interviews and talk on the BBC and so on. When I did my first private member's bill on the right to life, I noticed that I no longer got invited onto Question Time or any questions or any of those programs, which was a relief in some respects. But there is a danger that liberals, small L liberals, can themselves become extraordinarily intolerant about views they don't like. And let's face it, if there have been, and there have, over 10 million abortions, then that's a lot of people who themselves may be grieving and hurt about this. I was very struck in the House of Lords the week before last. We had a debate first thing in the morning on a report about premature babies' births. And in the course of that debate, a wonderful woman described what had happened to her baby that had been sadly miscarried. And I listened because I too had. I'm the father of miscarried babies, and so you these things do mean a great deal to you. I was a little shocked in the interview that followed, in the debate that followed, the same person then talked about how you could just dispose of an unborn child, literally into the lavatory, and this was a matter of choice. And yet she clearly had felt deeply and sensitively about what had happened to her own unborn child. So we have to try and help people move and see that this is not about condemnation. It's not trying to impose guilt on people or something of that kind. It's about saying, when do you believe that life begins? And how should protection work from that point on? I mean, I often make the point that by 18 weeks gestation, which is about, by the way, the upper time limit for abortion in a country like Sweden, which is regarded as quite a social democratic state across the European Union, the upper time limits are around 12 to 14 weeks. Nowhere allows this barbarism of abortion up to and even during birth. But I often make the point that by 18 weeks gestation, of course, an unborn child feels pain. All its organs are in place. What do you do when you actually carry out an abortion at that point? You literally dismember the child, and that baby is in presumably terrible pain. And if you're not certain whether the child is or not, then you should always presume that this will be the case, and on this well-known principle of philosophy, that you therefore would err on the side of caution, the precautionary principle, and that you would protect that child in that set of circumstances, because obviously the child isn't able to speak for itself. So you have a duty to do that. So legislators have to look at these things. You can't do it in 2 hours flat, as the House of Commons tried to do this week, with half a dozen speeches from one side and a handful from the other. That is not the way to go about these things. It's the only policy, massive policy, 10 million abortions since it was legalized, where there has, to the best of my knowledge, never ever been a full royal commission or major public inquiry into whether it's doing what was intended. The original movers of the legislation, you can read the Hansards back in 1967, said this form is not to be used other than in very extreme circumstances. Hundreds now take place every day. Some people have several proportions. And now we're going to say you can do it yourself, administer it at home, with no doctor or help being present. What danger does that present for the woman who is involved? You know, both lives matter to me. This is not about being a misogynist, bigot, or all the other things you're accused of. Both lives matter. What will happen to that woman in those circumstances? What will be the emotional effects, let alone the physical ones, on her if these things go wrong? And how can you justify the taking of a life right up to and even during birth on any ground, such as, for instance, gender? We know that there are gender abortions in the UK. There's evidence of that. And in some countries, of course, in China, where there was forced coercive abortion, aided and abetted by British taxpayers' money, I might add, there are now 30 million more men than there are women. Because if you could only have one child, you chose to have a male and not a female. And many societies are patriarchal societies of that kind, where people will be coerced or pushed into aborting baby girls. So this is what we are permitting, and it begs the question, why are we not having a thorough and open debate about these things? And I hope maybe the shock that a lot of people genuinely feel about this, who are not pro-life, but who think this just goes too far, I hope that they will open this debate and that we'll be respectful of each other's differing views. We will understand that some people are deeply hurt by their own personal experiences and that we must enter into those arguments.
Thank you. If I've understood you properly, you're resisting slightly my attempt to frame this in Christian pagan terms and instead replacing it with this is much more accessibly a human rights issue. And I take the point. And I think in terms of political pragmatism, that's probably what both wise, sensible and more likely to be successful. So let me just ask you a bit more about that.
If people want to, they can go back and look at things like Pope John Paul II's encyclical on life itself. It's beautifully written, of course, and it sets out the arguments. But go to Dr. Rowan Williams, the former Archbishop of Canterbury, who in measured, intelligent, compassionate terms sets out the case for life itself. So this is from right across the Christian divide. I mean, there are differences of opinions, but there are also considerable people that you can draw on. I would encourage people to read Tom Holland's book, Dominion. Here's someone who's on his own journey. You know, he started off, I think, baptized in the Church of England, sort of discarded his faith as he went along and sort of rediscovered some of it. But his book is absolutely brilliant. And he says, actually, we moved from paganism to Christianity when a Roman woman, and I think this is about 600 or so AD, went out onto the street and started to pick up discarded babies that people did not want and were being left on the street to die, infanticide. And Tom Holland argues that that was the moment where we actually saw that humanity mattered more than just the utilitarianism or the eugenics and the belief you could just dispose of an unwanted life and do it because of the right to choose. I'd unpack that slogan, my right to choose. It puts me at the heart of the equation. It puts rights rather than duties and obligations. And it puts choice, which derives from the same Greek word as the word heresy. And it is a sort of modern heresy. It's, as Tim Farron said last week, a choice between libertarianism or liberalism. And if liberalism means anything, it's about standing up for people who are unable to stand up and speak for themselves. So however unpopular it makes you, and in my case, it led to me leaving a political party when they made abortion a party policy. But I was with a friend last night who was deselected as a candidate of a last general election because he wouldn't give up his passionate belief in the right to life of the unborn child. We mustn't hound people out because they take a contrary view. We must listen respectfully to other people's points of view and see that sometimes maybe you do need to rethink and recalibrate. So read Tom Holland and Dominion, but also go back to things like the dignity of life that John Paul wrote about. Go back to Jonathan Sacks, who said that everything has become an item of disposability and it shouldn't. Look at the great teachers, but also those many of whom, as I say, who may have no religious belief, but who see the arguments in other terms. That's why I fall back in the end on things like the European Convention on Human Rights, the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, and not just articles saying that everyone has the right to life. Article 3 of the ECHR also prescribes against torture. Read the science around the pain that is inflicted on the unborn child, the ability to sense everything that is being done to them. It is what changed the mind of a man who ran the biggest abortion clinic in America, Bernard Davidson. And he had allowed cameras in to watch him doing his work. And when he saw the child in the womb on the film who was being aborted using his instruments, and seeing that child trying to escape and shelter in the womb, he changed his mind and he became one of the leading advocates to say we have to have a different view about this. So as I keep saying, I'm not interested in trying to impose my views on anybody else, but I want to see change. A hero of mine was William Wilberforce, over 200 years ago. He challenged, because of his faith, that he wasn't a Christian when he started. He became one as a result of the massive renewal of religion in the country in the 1780s and 90s, primarily led by people like John and Charles Wesley. Wilberforce, having come to faith, he said, well, I've got to do something about what is the biggest evil in our country today, and that is my right to choose to own another person as a slave merely because of the colour of their skin. And Wilberforce spent 40 long years building an alliance, the Quaker ladies, the lawyers, Granville Sharp, Guido Equiano, who'd escaped from slavery, Thomas Clarkson, who was the organiser, quit his studies at Cambridge University in order to spend the rest 60 years of his life organizing against something that they saw as an abomination. They eventually succeeded. There were great vested interests pitted against them, but they changed hearts, they changed minds, and eventually they changed laws. So I hope there will be in this rising generation people like Wilberforce and Clarkson. I hope there will be people who, when I'm long dead and gone, who will succeed in changing attitudes and hearts and minds. And I think that's more important even than changing the laws. Two lives are at stake here. We have a duty to be pro-life in every respect and to get alongside vulnerable women who feel perhaps they have no choice. And that, I think, is a challenge to us all as well.
Well, thank you so much for giving us such a clear picture, both of the pagan Christian narrative, but also of the human rights one. Can I just pursue the human rights one a bit more? Because you were talking about cognitive dissonance, and I think that's very important. Because it is odd the way in which people can hold two contradictory ideas in their heads at the same time. And one of the ways of resolving that is to show them that this is... that these are contradictory. And so I'm quite interested in and wonder whether or not, given that this is partly a product of feminism and the right to choose, or women seeing themselves as victims of men, and pregnancy as a sort of form of casualty of an encounter with men. If we take the figures, 10 million abortions in this country, that's 5 million women who didn't get to live. Have you noticed any key to the cognitive dissonance in terms of committed feminists waking up to the idea that there are two things a woman can do? One is own her body, and the other is protect a growing woman in her body. I mean, clearly their choices, one seems to me to be more moral than the other, but they're both feminist issues. Is there any way in which the sanctity of the unborn girl child, at any rate, even if a boy child brings less sympathy with some people than others, is there any way in which the sanctity of a girl child can become a feminist issue? Or are we stuck with a certain form of kind of primitive politicization of gender disparity?
It's a good question, Gavin. And I was very moved last night to read Professor Kathleen Stock, who,
yes,
you and I would be on different sides of a number of arguments, perhaps. But I'm impressed that even though she's been ostracized because around the trans issue and lost her teaching post as a consequence of holding what is a contradictory, controversial view to the spirit of the age, as a result, but she is a feminist. I mean, no doubt about what her views are. And this is what she said last night. late-term abortions kill babies, viable babies. This position doesn't require there to have been a baby human person there all along. Pushing back on full decriminalization isn't arguing for no abortions ever, which obviously could be done, but I'm not doing it. She says babies at late term have unambiguous interests of their own. They're not just narcissistic extensions of mother. They are not parasites or invaders. They're human beings. They're dependent human beings. And it's weird to see feminists who talk about value of care and dependence become psychopathically detached about the value for the life of a dependent viable baby because the mother doesn't want it. So, you know, this
psychopathically detached. That's really that's nuclear words from a feminist.
They are. They are. So this, you know, my wife is passionate about the rights of an unborn child. So are millions of women in this country. They're often voices that are not listened to or heard and pushed to the side because people say, oh, you've been over-influenced by religion or whatever it may be. So somehow we have to recalibrate the arguments, and we've got to do it by building alliances with people. And sometimes there'll be unexpected allies.
Well, I think that's the strength of your human rights argument as against my pagan Christian dichotomy. And because I'm sure that's right. If you have an alliance that's built between John Paul II and Kathleen Stock, then you've got a fairly formidable team. And Kathleen was when I was a lecturer at Sussex, Kathleen was a colleague of mine. And in those days, we would have been on different sides of many debates, but this one brings us, as you've quite rightly pointed out, together. And she's a formidable woman and an enormously competent ally.
Yeah.
So it's just entirely possible that some of the more clear thinking feminists might have some influence on the politicization. Just going back to one of the earlier questions, what do you put the fundamentalism down to? There was the speed with which this took place, the dogmatism, the closed-mindedness, the extraordinary radical, unambiguous language, as you quite rightly say, almost of eugenics. What analysis do you bring to bear on what's behind this? Don't really put words into your mouth. How do you see it?
No, I think there is a political ideology at work here. I saw it in my former party as well, which has become deeply intolerant. And people think you're pointing a finger at them, probably because of a decision that they may have made in their own lives. And in some cases, it's unhealed. There is regret, but people don't know how to square that circle. And sometimes I think we have to ask ourselves, how have we expressed the arguments? And have we done it in a way that is reasonable? Or have we been intolerant in the way that we express them? So mine is an appeal, really, to stop this roller coaster that is moving across Parliament at the moment, because to have had 2 hours of debate about something that is of such significance as this is intolerable. And I hope that the House of Lords will be able to either take us at least back to the position that applied before the amendment was passed. But if it can't do that, then at least to find a way of encouraging the government to take this issue, because in the end, this is inside a government bill, to take it away and put it before something like a Royal Commission or a wide-scoped select committee inquiry, as we've had here in the House of Lords in the past. I mean, for instance, people, I think, had instinctive views about the end of life issues, and it took Lord Mackay of Clashfern and a brilliant select committee of the House of Lords to analyse hundreds and hundreds of pages of evidence and to point out what issues were at stake. That it wasn't just about my right to tell a doctor to end my life. It was about the complicity then of the medical profession in what you decided to do. It was about the effects it could specifically have on disabled people, who of course are passionately opposed to it. It challenged the idea that this could all just be reduced again to the question of personal choice, autonomy over the wider societal questions. So I just hope that people will dwell a pause and look again at the substantial issues which are at stake here. It's not a trivial question.
I know Lord Mackay of Clashfern has an extraordinary mind, and as you say, was a wonderful resource. I know it's a rhetorical point, but I mean, but foxes got a good deal more parliamentary attention.
Well, it was the point I first raised, actually, in
our children. Parliament, where I borrowed it from you then.
Yes, I contrasted the hundreds of hours that we had spent on fox hunting with the tiny amount of time that is set aside. We had a debate on a bill by my colleague Lord Moylan a couple of weeks ago, a private member's bill, that simply wants an annual report, data, in other words, you know, evidence to build a case on either direction to look at complications that have arisen as a result of sending pills out through the post to abort a bill.
Absolutely.
And the hostility on the floor of the House of Lords from people who are absolutist on this issue, who wouldn't even tolerate the idea of collecting the data. It's called the right to know. So you think, well, where do you even start? So again, this is not about the grown-ups, as it were, in the House of Lords. There are a lot of people here who have been committed to the abortion of ideology, who are, I mean, they're perfectly reasonable people on a variety of issues, but not on this one. I mean, you know,
I'm about to let you go because I know you've got a very busy schedule, but can I just pick up this last point? I think it's so important. On one side of the argument, people are saying, but look, we're simply decriminalizing women. Doctors remain liable under the law, which is still fairly strict in terms of making a distinction between medical unviability and psychological or sociological problems. So relax, don't worry about that. But you quite rightly say that the pills through the post development opens the door to circumventing the rules. And one of the problems, as you know more than anybody else, is that the guidelines given at the beginning of this whole process of legalizing abortion have been twisted out of shape. They've been dissolved beyond recognition. The law hasn't held. It hasn't been absolved. And the pills through the post episode seems to me to be an obvious way of subverting the law so it can't be imposed. Can you just give a little... Can you make? I mean, I'd like to hear you on that point because I think it's in terms of people arguing what the position we're in, and taking being told that the law will continue to protect children in the womb. If you're really saying that there are people in the House of Lords who won't even hear what the data is on the pills and the postman, let alone consider the way in which it subverts the law, then we're in a bit of trouble legislatively, aren't we?
Yes, we are. We are in trouble. But again, silent majorities. On the end of life issues, I was told 20 years ago, we will never stop the slide into euthanasia. And it's been like Sisyphus pushing a boulder up the hill. It's always coming back down, more and more attention again and again and again. But the extraordinary thing is that whereas Holland and Belgium and Canada and some of the American US states have gone much further than we have on these laws. We have held this back so far. And that is because of the alliance that was built here in the House of Lords from right across the spectrum. One of my colleagues is a very celebrated lawyer, told me when we were in the House of Commons together, David, I can't vote with you on your bill. I know why you're doing it. I do respect you for doing it, but I'm pro-choice. So, but if ever the euthanasia issue comes up, call on me. Why? Because he had family who died during the Holocaust.
Yes, absolutely.
I called on him. He is a trustee with me of Living and Dying Well. He said, if I have any religious beliefs, then someone better tell me what they are, because I don't know. On that same committee, there's a professor of palliative care. She is brilliant. She's a sort of Esther for our time, Baroness Finlay. And there's my friend, Baroness Tanny Gray Thompson, Paralympic athlete, who has no religious beliefs. That alliance, I would say, is one of the reasons why, so far, we have been able to resist the slide into euthanasia through the assisted dying route, which some in the House of Commons, of course, are promoting now so strongly. I'm not saying it won't ever happen, but I'm saying it didn't happen 20 years ago. And so far, we've been able to resist it by, I think, the right kind of intelligence being deployed and gathering the evidence and asking people some significant questions. And enlisting on our side of the argument people with whom we might not always agree. And I, you know, many of the people I've just mentioned wouldn't agree with me about early life issues. I would say it's utterly consistent. I would say that my opposition to the death penalty is utterly consistent with my position on ending the life of an unborn child. I would say that my position on the inflicting of torture, which is banned by Article 3 of the European Convention of Human Rights, is utterly consistent with what you do to a child in the womb. Now, I'm not, I just think I want to be heard on those things, and I'm grateful to you, Gavin, for giving me the chance to state some of my views. But there are many other people who hold these views too, and I hope that we will provide platforms for them. And it may be, it just may be, that this is overreach on the part of those who've got this massive ideological commitment and who pulled their colleagues into the division lobbies in the House of Commons with them this week. It just may be that this is the wake-up call that this country has needed. In 1967, they said it would only be used in extreme circumstances. 98% of the more than 10 million abortions that have taken place, that's hundreds every single day, 98% are done under the social clause, which wasn't even in the bill when it was first presented to the House of Commons all those years ago. Only 2% have anything to do with the so-called hard cases. And as we know, hard cases make very bad
laws. Yes. Lord David Walton, thank you for everything you've done in fostering those politically potent alliances and holding back that tsunami. So I think we have a cause to be very grateful to you and to your like-minded colleagues and fellow travellers. And thank you for all you're doing. And we have to offer you our prayers and continued spiritual and political support for the campaign. And we're extremely grateful. So, and thank you for giving us this time this morning when you got so little of it. We're very grateful.
Well, thank you, Gavin. Let's give the last word to Lord Tennyson, our great poet laureate from Victorian times, who said that more things are wrought by prayer than this world ever dreams of. And for those who are watching the podcast and who believe in prayer, I think it was Augustine who said, pray as if the entire outcome depends upon God, and work as if the entire outcome depends upon you.
Tennyson, Augustine, and Alton, formidable trio. Thank you. God bless you.
Thank you.